Hello, curious minds, scrutinizers, and excavationists. I am excited to be with all of you today for our weekly installment of Right Minded, and I'm here with my favorite person in the world to talk about this fabulous combination of literature and inspiration, and that is my co-host, Grant Faulkner. Hey, Grant.
Hello.
So we have talked about historical fiction in past episodes, and I'm particularly happy to have today's guest, Christina Baker Klein, who's an old friend of mine, and she is a former Seal Press author and someone who's long been a generous champion of She Writes. It's interesting because, as you'll hear in the interview today, Christina actually takes issue with this term, historical fiction, noting that it's a category that is applied to female novelists, where it is not applied to men who write about the past. And this is good for us to be, you know, thinking about the ways in which publishing does ghettoize certain kinds of writers and certain, especially women. So I just wanted to kind of bring that out at the top, because I have always referred to historical fiction without really any qualms, and she might be changing my tune a little bit. Christina is the author of 8 novels, and the last 3 have been about the past. And so we'll just call it what it is, writing about the past. And the thing about history and historical novels, or just novels that are about the past, is that Christina notes that, you know, it's largely a one-sided kind of history because it's written by the winners and the conquerors, and we don't often get to see the hidden stories unless someone like Christina comes along to unearth them. So, Grant, what I wanted to talk about was that, you know, most writers confront the past in some way, shape, or form. And obviously, that's probably why Christina is saying, like, why do we call this historical fiction when we're all informed by our past, including even fantasy and sci-fi authors who are writing about the future, but often drawing from the past, right?
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes on this subject comes from William Faulkner. He said, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And for him, that applied to his novels, of course, because he was writing about the South. And even when he was writing about a contemporary story, his point was that the past was very present, especially the racist past of slavery, which is obviously still very present today, and not just in the South, of course. So yes, I think it's really interesting when writers reckon with the past in such a way, no matter if it's a Rebecca Roanhorse and her futuristic novels that draw from indigenous cultures of the past, or Percy Jackson putting a contemporary spin on the Greek myths.
Right. Yeah. It's such an interesting point, you know, but of course we're drawing from what we know, and worlds are built from the worlds of the past. I mean, I've heard Christina speak about the responsibility that writers have to honor the truth of what happened. I mean, it depends on the topic, of course, but I think this is something that is different between contemporary and past novels, because if you're really drawing from history, then you might feel that you have a deeper responsibility to mine the truths, and of course, to do the research. And so I did want to say just a short sentence or two about each of her 3 books that are about the past that she's going to talk a bit about today. Orphan Train is the most well-known. This is a fascinating story about the orphan trains that ran from the East Coast to the Midwest between 1854 and 1929. And they were taking thousands of abandoned children to uncertain fates in the Midwest. And it really shaped the Midwest, as you can well imagine. And then A Piece of the World, in this book, her subject is Christina Olson, who was the inspiration for artist Andrew Wyeth for 20 years. And then most recently, just out this year, is The Exiles, which is about 3 women whose lives are bound together in 19th century Australia and the hardships that they had to weather together, you know, as they're really trying to figure out freedom in a brand new society. And they're very different, you know, and so I appreciate that we get to hear from Christina about this journey and sort of how she stumbled onto each of these stories. And also about today's topic, you know, pleasures and perils of writing about the past, because it's both, right? And I thought it'd be interesting, Grant, to talk about what each of us sees as the pleasures and perils based on what we see from our students or nano writers or writers we know. And I thought it'd be fun if you take on fiction and I take on memoir, and each of us speaks to just a couple of the pleasures and perils we see or that have come up in a regular way.
Yeah, have fun. I think one of the biggest pleasures of writing about the past is that you're going into another world almost as entirely as you're entering a fantasy world. It's just that different. You have to work your imagination to figure out how people possibly ever drove, you know, did these mundane things. Like, how did they drive to another town, let alone across the country without a maps app? Or how did businesses do their books in 1920? Or, you know, what did it look like to take a trip from Boston to New York in 1750? Everything requires research, especially small mundane acts, which is a great pleasure of many novelists. In fact, I've heard some novelists say that they write historical novels so they can do the research. But that can also be perilous as well, because sometimes people can over-research, which means that research can stand in the way of actually writing a novel. Or sometimes I've heard people say that they feel like they have to get all of that research into the story, so their research really crowds out their imagination. I think it's a real art to do just enough research so that it serves to spark your imagination, because an historical novel should be as imaginative as much or more than it should be factual. So that's a final pleasure. You can take some liberties while reimagining the past.
Yeah, it's interesting. And for memoirists, well, I'm going to start with the perils, because it's such a big fear that memoirists have, the perils of writing about other people and what happened to you, you know, especially if someone wronged you or hurt you. And that is a big, scary, hairy topic for most memoirists. But ultimately, if you're writing your truth, unless you are actually defaming someone, you are within your rights to tell your story and what happened to you. And that is why so many memoirists do, in fact, tell stories about their abusers or people who have hurt them in some way. Because taking someone to court to disprove that you, in fact, abused them would require you to go to court to disprove this thing that probably happened. A memoirist is unlikely to, you know, say that something like that happened if it didn't. So people get their minds wrapped around, you know, what they can and can't do. And I think that is one of the perils, because it kind of stands as an obstacle. In terms of the pleasures, I mean, memoir obviously is also all about the past. Memoir is memory. And so the pleasures are there in mining the memory, is to make sense of what happened to you or of your experience. And then also, I think memoirists write a lot to reclaim their own past, to reclaim their own story, and to give voice to what happened. And so in my experience, there are just so many beautiful benefits for memoirists that come from writing about the past. And I think that is part of why it's such a popular genre, and one that especially lately is drawing so many writers to the page, you know, to explore the life that they lived and what meaning it has both for themselves and for their readers.
Yeah, Brooke, I haven't dug up any publishing numbers, but it seems to me that historical fiction is getting more popular and really having its day. And maybe that's because of the internet, ironically. I think people have a yearning to return to another time, or to understand a time when we owned our lives more, you know, when we weren't tethered to a device, and when we, you know, kind of had to put our hands into the soil, so to speak. I've never written historical fiction, but I have a strong desire to, because in many cases, your drama is determined for you. It's factual. So instead of construing a plot in the traditional sense, you're writing to understand a moment and bring it to life. You're interpreting history at the same time that you're revealing it and exploring it.
Yeah, I totally agree, Grant. And I think if I were going to write a novel, I would probably choose historical fiction. And, you know, it's funny because we do the interviews before we do the banter. And I was struck by Christina bristling at the historical fiction category. And I really honor that reaction. And it makes so much sense. And I want to just address it, because I think it's important around publishing. And I have strong feelings about categories as a publisher, because what happens in publishing is that the publishing world is trying to categorize work of writers for the sake of selling the books. I think one of the unfortunate things that happens in book publishing is that male writers get to write stories for everyone, whereas women writers usually are writing stories for women. And that's not to say that that's where the author is coming from, but lots of times that's how the publishing industry is positioning these works. And so at She Writes Press, we're doing a lot of historical fiction. And I think that part of the reason that that's happening is because we're a women's press, and you'll see historical fiction a lot of times that genre, that category, having covers that look very much like they are directed toward women, right? And men are probably unlikely to pick up those books as a result. And so there's something about the packaging and the conceptualizing of historical fiction as a women's genre. And so it's what I'm guess I'm trying to get at is that the very thing that Christina is saying, this is a problem at She Writes Press, there's a way in which we embrace that because we're kind of okay with not all of our books, but many of our books being for women readers. And so I think it's a larger and really interesting conversation. I have felt really lucky to publish a lot of the books that we have qualified as historical fiction, including Little Women in Blue, which is a book by Janine Atkins about May Alcott, the sister of Louisa Alcott, who wrote Little Women. We published a book called Dark Lady by Charlene Ball, which tells the story of Amelia Bassano Lanier, who was known to be Shakespeare's lover. And some people think that she wrote or contributed to a lot of his work, which is fascinating. Another book that is solidly historical fiction for us is called Answer Creek by Ashley Sweeney, which is about the Donner Party and tells the story of what really happened, to this group that's actually best known for cannibalizing their own when they got stuck on Donner Pass. And she kind of sets the record straight on that. And so, these are fascinating stories to read. And for anybody who is not, a avid fan of historical novels in particular, that certainly they're not only for women. and I encourage you to start there with three of ours.
Yeah, what a sampling, Brooke. And so cool that She Writes does so much historical fiction. So thanks for sharing those books. And without much further ado, folks, we're going to pivot to our interview with Christina, which will be delivered to your listening device right after this short and very beautiful musical interlude.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we have with us the number one New York Times bestselling author of 8 novels, Christina Baker Klein, whose most recent books are The Exiles, Orphan Train, and A Piece of the World. She's widely published and has won many prizes, including the New England Prize for Fiction, the Maine Literary Award, and a Barnes & Noble Discover Award. Her essays, articles, and reviews have appeared all over the place. I'm not even going to read the list. Christina is very impressive to see. And I know that you split your time between New York City and Southwest Harbor, Maine. Hi, Christina. So happy to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be here. I'm not so much splitting these days. We came to Maine on March 13th.
I was going to say, you're more in Maine than New York, and I think we know why.
Yeah, it's a little crazy.
Is it more conducive to writing up there for you?
Well, it should be. Theoretically, it is. But I think a combination of the, for me at least, a combination of the crazy political world of the moment, and the, all of that. And then we actually bought a new house up here too. So we've bought and sold a house. So it's been kind of busy. And I forgot my book came out. That was the big thing.
Right. The Exiles. Yes. Congratulations. I downloaded it and listened to it on Audible, which was fun to hear the Australian accent. And we'll ask more about that in just a second. We'll get to the heart of the interview here because you've been writing historical fiction, including this new book, The Exiles, and congratulations. And I read a quote in the Chicago Review of Books where you said, "What we call history is almost always told from the perspective of the conquerors, a group that has typically excluded women, the poor, indigenous people." So I wanted to start with the question of how this truth informs how you approach writing historical fiction and the subjects that you choose.
I bridle against the term historical fiction, to be honest with you, because I think it's a female ghetto, largely. Mm. I think that men write about the past in all kinds of ways and aren't called historical fiction writers. And some people set out to write, a certain kind of what I would call historical romance that involves lots of period detail, attention to the cuffs of outfits. And, there is a whole world of that. But I think maybe because I wrote contemporary novels, and then I sort of fell backwards into writing about the past because I wrote a novel called Orphan Train that 2/3 of it takes place in the present day, and 100 pages is during the time of the Orphan Trains. My husband's grandfather was featured in an article on Orphan Train Riders, and he was orphaned and sent to North Dakota, and that was how it started. I never thought I would continue writing books set in the past, but as soon as that book came out, I kind of stumbled into another story about Andrew Wyeth in the mid-20th century, actually. So again, that didn't seem all that historical to me, but it was the same time period in American. It was rural America in the early to mid 20th century. And I had learned so much about it that I decided to stick to that period. And then The Exiles is a true departure. It really is. It's set in the 1840s, so 100 years before anything I'd ever written. But I had, for all of these reasons, I had been really interested in Australia, and I taught in a women's prison. And so learned a lot about the criminal justice system and what incarceration is like. And as you said, I have found in my work that I'm interested in the stories of people, the stories that haven't been told, that of people who haven't been a part of the official record of history. And so I am not sure I answered your question.
You did. And Christina, you brought up something really interesting to me. I'm just thinking of one novel, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, which is classified as literary fiction, even though it's about World War II. And so these interesting ways that books are categorized and how they might be categorized by the gender of the author is fascinating.
Yeah, I think you'll notice it now. I mean, Colson Whitehead isn't called a historical novelist. His last novel was had nothing meta about it. It was, it was very much set in a place and time. And Salman Rushdie, I mean, the list goes on and on. But yeah, Anthony Doerr is an interesting one because I think men do often escape that. I did a New York Public Library event with a very serious literary novelist called Lisa Gornick. And she wrote a novel set in the past and sort of was encountering this. And so we had this conversation about it. And then we wrote it as an essay for Poets and Writers about that sort of interesting conundrum. So
oh, cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. How we get categorized and why and where.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to try not to refer to your work as historical fiction throughout this interview here, but
No, you can. It's fine. Well, I was just going to say the truth is, having, fallen on that sword, I then did write a novel, The Exiles, which I would say more squarely fits into the sort of the definition of the genre, in that it truly is an adventure story. I mean, Peace of the World, my last novel, was much more sort of subtle in its dramas and was very interior. The whole novel was essentially took place in one room. And so this one is much more of this sort of hero's journey adventure story.
One thing that fascinates me about this, I guess I've never really written a novel that takes place in the past that I have to really research. And I read that you felt more bound to the historical record, I guess, than you thought you would be while writing Orphan Train. Mm. And so I'm always curious about that balancing act of, adding your imagination and taking creative license while also respecting the historicity, if that's a word, of the work.
Yeah. I've come to think of it like writing formal poetry. When I was in college, I studied poetry mostly, more than fiction. And I wrote a lot of complicated verse, like sestinas, where you have these rigid rules that define the structure of the poem, and then you have to work within them. And in a way, writing novels that require so much research and have so many sort of roots in the soil of the past gives you all these kind of rules. And then what's interesting is to create story and imagery and characters in that setting. Because when you write contemporary fiction, you can do anything you want. So in my last novel, for example, I was writing about people who lived, and some of whom are still alive. So Andrew Wyeth died. But his son, who's in my novel, is named Jamie Wyeth, and he's also a significant painter, artist. And I ended up even doing an event with him. And that was really strange. Also, the Wyeth Foundation is very litigious and they're very serious about their reputation and everything. So I wanted to get the facts right. I didn't want to whitewash anything, but I needed to sort of know what I was doing. And that involved a lot of research into art history as well. I think when you take on a subject, especially one that feels significant in some way that people don't know much about, I at least feel a responsibility to work with the facts as much as I can. And with this novel, The Exiles, I have an Aboriginal character who was a real person. And so I felt especially bound to that story, to making sure that I really understood it and had the facts right on it.
Well, Christina, in prepping for this, I watched a presentation that you gave about Orphan Train. It was like an hour-long presentation someplace in Michigan. And it was just fascinating how it came about, first of all, right? That there was this connection to your in-laws. And what struck me was this truth that I see a lot of authors doing, which is like they find these stories that have not been told and then feel like they maybe would like to not tell the story, but there's no not telling the story because it's kind of infiltrated your brain. And that's a little bit how I saw this unfolding for you. But what strikes me, of course, is like now you've stayed in this niche for the last several books of plumbing the past. And so I just wanted to ask you about that experience and whether it surprised you. Because, I mean, you and I have known each other a long time, well before all of these novels, and you were really doing more just kind of straightforward nonfiction back in the day. And now I feel like you're known for this totally other thing. And so I was just wondering if you could talk about the journey and also about, you know, what happens when an idea worms its way into your mind and won't let you go.
I mean, I think that what I would say is that I always had, I had the impulse to write fiction, but that my contemporary novels, and a lot of people describe this sort of process, came together as I felt like a magpie. I would find a germ of an idea and then I'd build another idea onto it. I'd sort of layer things together and pull the story together that way. But for these stories, these recent ones, and this is what happened with Orphan Train first, I have this sort of, I learn about something in some offhanded way, and I have this sort of tingle, this spidey sense, like that this, it's huge and terrifying. And what I've learned is that impulse is one that I should follow. In other words, if it seems too big and too overwhelming and that I don't know what I'm doing, I should probably do it. And that's sort of how it's worked lately. And my next idea is the same way. It's a completely different world. And that's one thing about these recent books. They're all set in completely different places with entirely different world building. So they're all separate challenges in that way. But I really like writing about the present day also, and the kind of naturalness of the dialogue, because of course we understand the dialogue today. And so I do think I'll go back to it eventually. But I think the wonderful thing about writing about the past is that you learn two things that seem contradictory. One, people are always the same. Meaning emotions are the same and the perception is the same, but a lot changes too. And for women, what has changed is, and for many disenfranchised people is getting laws passed that enable them to have more freedom. And that makes a huge difference for people. So having being able to walk freely in the world, to being able to vote, all those things. The world was extremely different 100 years ago or 150 years ago. And it's not because people were different per se. It's because laws have changed All of our activism, Brooke, has made a difference.
Yay.
This question is more on the topic of creative process, because I know that one of the subjects you teach is structure. And I'm curious about how structure, you know, informs your creative process, and how much do you map out your novels in advance?
I think I'm the least good at structure, which is why it's, and it's in some ways structure's the most important thing, right? Yeah. Because you, otherwise you have just pretty words on a page, uh-huh. but you don't have conflict and you don't have development. And so I've had to impose structure on my books. And sometimes it means stealing structure from other books. And sometimes it means stealing plot unfolding. So I'll give you examples. My first novel is called Sweetwater, and it is about a Southern family and their sort of internecine battles, I guess. And it's set in the present day of the 90s when I wrote it. But it's actually the entire structure and the story is based on the Oresteia by Aeschylus. The Oresteia is a series of three Greek plays. And I just copied that. I just copied the structure of it. And nobody picked it up except for one reviewer who noticed the similarities. And because I use the same, I mean, I use variations on the Greek names, like Orestes became Horace. and it was really fun to do it. Cassandra is the daughter who is destined to be to speak the truth, but never to be believed. And so I have a character who's the central character who is sort of the truth teller. So anyway, that. And then for my last novel, A Piece of the World, I used a screenwriting guide called Save the Cat. It's just the simplest. I just mapped the whole book. I did an outline of Save the Cat, basically, of the basics. And the story that I told was so, as I said, insular, quiet, you know, not dramatic. And that book saved me, because I had to create conflict and drama in a story in which nothing happens. And so I did. And that was thanks in part to Save the Cat. And then my last novel, The Exiles, it was the first time I've ever done this, but I used Joseph Campbell's, as I said, I mentioned earlier, The Hero's Journey. I actually mapped out the hero's journey over three characters. So you follow the first character for a certain period, and then you switch to the next character, and then you go to the third, and it follows the 12 steps.
It's so interesting, because, you know, immediately what came to mind is that Jane Smiley's 1,000 Acres is based on King Lear.
Yes.
And that's all kinds of celebrated. You know, I mean, I think people love it when structure is lifted like that, if it's done in kind of an intentional way with a classic story. So that's fun to know.
Definitely. And I highly recommend stealing structure from from Shakespeare, or from the Greeks, or from contemporary novels. I was absolutely obsessed with Michael Cunningham's The Hours when I was writing Bird in Hand, the last contemporary novel I wrote. And I didn't exactly use his structure, but I that book was sort of a talisman for me. I it was really helpful.
Well, I love it too, because not enough authors give that kind of permission. And so it's just, there's all kinds of inspiration out there for the taking. So yay to shamelessly stealing. And, you know, in closing, I want to ask you, I mean, you're such a prolific writer, and I know that you have these idea boards that can get pretty involved when you're working on a novel. I love this idea, because I encourage my own students to do it. And I think people like it more as an idea rather than something that they actually do. And so I wanted to ask you, what inspired this for you? And then what are some other ways that you recommend writers generate creative inspiration?
Boy, there are so many ways. I mean, something as simple, I don't know if either of you do this, but I don't write with music usually, but late in the afternoon, I can get myself to write another page or two if I listen to music that's pretty loud and kind of sweeps me away. Mm-hmm. And I often do some of the more interesting contemplative moments of my novel in those moments, but I can't force them in the morning. I, you know, my normal writing routine is not quite as freeform, but with a glass of wine and some music in the afternoon, I can get at things sometimes that I couldn't get at in my ordinary course of writing. There's a way in which giving yourself permission to write anywhere is helpful. Like writing on trains can be very immersive. So there's something about the motion, the fact that you're sitting there in a bubble, and it can be quite comforting. And I find myself swept away, or writing on a bus or a subway, grabbing moments that you wouldn't expect to grab, not setting rules for yourself about how and when you write. All of those things that's the only way I get books done, is to remove all the kind of barriers that I normally have up about, like, I can't write then, or I have to write with two cups of coffee, or I think we do that a lot. It's scary to sit down every morning to the blank page. So how do you keep doing it? How do you make it fresh? I mean, when my kids were young, I used to go, and before COVID, I used to go to coffee shops, and I wish I could go to a coffee shop right now, you know, and have that experience that's outside of the home and separate and inspiring, and with ambient music that isn't my own. I like that.
We'll get back to that someday.
Someday. I hope yeah. so. I hope so.
Christina, thank you so much. I also look forward to traveling and seeing you again in the future. So super grateful to have you on the show today.
Oh, I hope so too. Thank you so much, Brooke. I had a wonderful time.
We will be right back with today's book talk.
Well, this week's book pick is another She Writes Press book. I have to, because we just have so many great historical novels. And in this case, The Velveteen Daughter by Laurel Davis Huber is actually probably our best selling of this genre. It's the story of Marjorie Williams Bianco, who is the author of one of the most beloved children's books of all times, which is The Velveteen Rabbit. And she had a daughter named Pamela, who was actually a world-renowned child prodigy artist. And she was, you know, when she was quite young, like 13 or 14, much more famous than her mother. And people don't know that, of course, because The Velveteen Rabbit is what lives on. And so this book delves into the glamorous art world of Europe and New York in the early 20th century. Picasso makes an appearance, Richard Hughes and Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. And so it's really a fun book to read. And I particularly loved it because it centers around the consequences of genius touched by madness, which is, you know, always kind of a timeless topic, and this incredible mother-daughter relationship. And so I highly recommend it. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Brooke. And thanks to everybody for joining us on Right Minded, which is a weekly podcast dedicated to the consequences of genius touched by madness. You can download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you could give us a rating, that would be wonderful. And we'll see you next week.